Lecture 75, The Rise of Mass Media.
In this lecture, I'd like to step back from the close narrative that we've been following in the previous lectures to look at a process of, over the whole 20th century, the development of mass media. 20th century America was almost universally literate, at least at some level. Thousands of newspapers throughout the century, including numerous foreign language papers that helped immigrants to adapt to the new world, were complemented by radio stations from the 1920s and by television stations from the late 1940s. These media, combined with the world's premier movie industry, enabled ordinary citizens to become extremely well-informed about their immediate surroundings and about more general political and social questions. The computer revolution of the late 20th century added further sophistication to this process, while the 1990s internet created a global village in which people everywhere could make instant contact with strangers on the other side of the world. Media moguls from Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst to Henry Luce and Ted Turner became nationally important figures in their own right. Media, moreover, did not just report the news. Often they created it, or at least gave it distinctive shape. Undertaking campaigns and crusades, supporting or denigrating political candidates, and of course relishing the scandals which sometimes beset public figures. Media power transformed the nature of politics, of lobbying, and even of the military, as the army discovered to its cost in the Vietnamese War. Well, the mass circulation of newspapers, first of all, accompanied the growth of something approaching universal literacy. Public schooling assured the rapid assimilation of new immigrants right from the beginning of the century. As new generations came in from many different parts of the world, their children would go to the public schools and learn how to read and speak at least some English. But in the early 20th century, America had a massive foreign language press. When I was talking about immigration earlier in the course, I read to you from The Rise of David Levinsky by Abraham Kahan. Kahan's job was as the editor of a Yiddish newspaper, the Jewish Daily Forward. And so it was a newspaper designed to teach immigrants in Yiddish, which they already knew, about how to start adapting to American life. But he was also a very, very prolific writer in English. Newspapers could embody the character of late 19th and early 20th century American cities, which had become too big for face-to-face relations. In the far smaller villages and towns of early American life, citizens could know one another. But already by 1900, the cities were much too big for all their citizens to know each other. But it was the newspaper which could provide some sense of civic unity and civic identity by tracking news from the entire area. And very often it was the local news, and particularly things like the sports news, where the city's sports teams created a focus of national urban energy, which could be followed and explained by the newspaper. So major league sports and cities' newspapers grew up together. The most skillful promoters of mass circulation newspapers were Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst. And they understood how to turn newspapers from a minority interest used by the most highly literate few into something that nearly everybody would want to buy. It was they who created big headlines, big pictures on the front page, very, very low prices, often through pricing wars, and high-quality writing, which was nevertheless very accessible. They also introduced cartoon strips. One of the names given to early 20th century newspapers is yellow journalism, and the term comes from a cartoon strip called The Yellow Kid. And in fact, Hearst and Pulitzer competed with one another to get this cartoonist, because they understood that readers would turn straight to the funnies, and that would be a way of bringing in readers to the ostensibly more serious news. They also loved melodrama and sentimentality. Hearst himself had been expelled from Harvard for riotous behavior, and his indignant father, looking for a way to get his son onto the straight and narrow, gave him the San Francisco Examiner. The father himself, a millionaire in the mining business, had inherited this newspaper as payment of a gambling debt. This was in the Barbary Coast days of San Francisco. Well, William Randolph Hearst proved to be superb as a newspaper editor and at developing it for a mass readership. He's the real person on whom Citizen Kane is based in the famous Orson Welles film. He hired many of the best writers of his era, including Mark Twain, Jack London, who for a while was the most highly paid writer in America, Stephen Crane, Richard Harding Davis. These were the great names in journalism at the beginning of the century. And eventually, Hearst managed to own 28 newspapers and 18 magazines. Before the technique for reproducing photographs was perfected in the first 10 years of the 20th century, it was also important to have illustrators. And artists like Frederick Remington and Gibson and Christie, themselves providing attractive and striking pictures for the newspapers, were also very highly paid components of this world. Hearst and his rival Pulitzer promoted crusades and campaigns of various kinds. And historians now, well, in fact, for a long time, have shown that it was the yellow press which contributed to America's going to war against Spain in Cuba in 1898. They themselves ran an anti-Spanish campaign, talking about the horrors of Spanish colonialism in Cuba, whipping up sympathy for the Cuban people and their aspiration for independence, and alleging that the American battleship, the Maine, had been blown up by a dastardly Spanish conspiracy. One headline in the New York Journal, a Hearst paper, the headline was, "War? Sure." That was, in other words, it's sort of a, it's not really a news story, it's really an editorial built right into the story. Later on, Hearst led a campaign against the red light district in San Francisco, posing as the guardian of moral purity. He urged his readers to petition the legislature, which was bombarded by citizens' indignant letters, and then they passed the Red Light Abatement Act in 1916, demonstrating that the newspaper could itself play an important policy role. At the same time, the mass circulation magazines were developing rapidly too, and they specialised in what was called muckraking. One part of the progressive era politics of the early 20th century was the exposure of wicked business practices by the great corporations, the trusts, the monopolies. And the magazine which specialised in this kind of work, McClure's, published several of the most famous. I quoted to you from Lincoln Steffens's book, The Shame of the Cities. Originally, it had been serialized in McClure's. Each chapter is about a different city and its corrupt political machine. Ida Tarbell was a gifted woman journalist who wrote an expose of the Rockefeller Corporation, Standard Oil, also published in McClure's in 1904. Now, of course, the editor's motive was to sell more copies. In other words, he was also a businessman, and he'd certainly carry advertisements from the corporations. So sometimes the criticism would be a tiny bit muted by the fact that McClure himself understood he mustn't antagonize the business community too much. But just as Theodore Roosevelt thought you could distinguish between the good trusts and the bad ones, so did McClure. You can accept the business system in general while singling out its faults. And in fact, there's a longer muckraking tradition in America which persists right up to the present. One of the most ingenious, I think, was an English immigrant, Jessica Mitford, who in the 1960s did a muckraking expose of the American funeral industry. And it's called The American Way of Death, published in about 1963, and full of macabre but hilarious details about the way in which the funeral industry manipulates people into spending far more money on funerals for their loved ones than they really ought to. And of course, muckraking journalism has a benign function because it brings businesses on notice that they mustn't deceive their customers, or they'll get noticed and get exposed for it. Well, radio broadcasting extended communication possibilities. Telegraphy, that is sending Morse code through wires, had already been perfected before the Civil War, principally by Samuel Morse. Radio technology developed out of telegraphy, and by 1900 it was already possible to send Morse code messages wirelessly, that is, for example, from ship to shore without relying on a wire to carry the message. The invention of the Audion tube in 1906 was the crucial breakthrough which made it possible to broadcast a voice or music as well as just a pattern of dots and dashes. At first, this was regarded as a fascinating development, and amateurs tinkered with it in various ways. But in 1917, when the United States went to war in the First World War, the US Navy took control of radio from fear of its espionage possibilities. It was understood that radio messages could be sent remotely. It wasn't until about 1920 that regular civilian broadcasting began. The first regular broadcasting station, as historians of radio tell it, was KDKA in Pittsburgh, owned by the Westinghouse Corporation. It's usually credited as being the first regular broadcaster. Very quickly, all kinds of people understood the possibilities of radio. One of the first groups to get into it were evangelical preachers, and of course they've persisted in radio and TV right up to the present. One of the most famous evangelical preachers of the 1920s was Amy Semple McPherson at the Angelus Temple in Los Angeles. She had a big radio station as well to broadcast her preaching, and in fact had a scandalous love affair with one of her radio technicians, which dented her credibility rather severely in 1927. The usual technique for running radio stations in America was commercially, that is, to pay the costs of the radio station through advertising. So the classic pattern in American radio became that you'd have a broadcast of the news or of concerts or of popular music interspersed with commercials, which would, and the advertiser would pay the radio station and cover its costs to make everything else possible. It didn't have to be that way, though, because at the same time in Britain, radio was developing in a very different way. The BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, the way in which that was financed was through licenses. If you wanted a radio, if you wanted to run a radio, you had to have a license for it, and the licensing fees paid the cost. And one of the early heads of the BBC, Lord Reith, had a very high-minded view of what radio should be. He said he saw it as a medium for the education of the whole British population. And early BBC radio had a highly didactic content, attempting to elevate the entire population. Well, very quickly, the American government realized that radio could be used or it could be abused. And so the Federal Radio Commission was created in 1927, which became the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, in 1934, an organization which again has persisted up to the present, to regulate the use of the airwaves and to prevent them from being misused. Ownership of radios in America grew from from zero in 1919 to 12 million in 1930. So it's one of the massive growths of the 20s, contributed to the great business boom of the 20s. And as I mentioned in one of the New Deal lectures, it was President Franklin Roosevelt who first understood the immense possibilities that radio provided. Warren G. Harding was the very first president to broadcast. But it was Roosevelt who really made the medium his own, and with the fireside chats, was able to appeal directly to American voters so that for the first time, many of them could listen to their president's voice directly, which previously would have been an unknown experience. By the time of the Great Depression, radio ownership was virtually universal, and Roosevelt's fireside chats were regularly deployed to shore up his policies. And as I mentioned, he had powerful rivals like the Father Charles Coughlin, the Catholic priest in Detroit, who began as one of his allies but progressively turned against Roosevelt for what he thought of as Roosevelt's complicity with a Jewish conspiracy of bankers. And it was Coughlin was one of the people who showed the possibilities of negative campaigning, which of course has been refined by politicians ever since. Radio, like the movie industry, created a wide range of fictional characters as well. It wasn't only a matter of news and concerts, it was also storytelling. Two of the most popular in the 1930s were Amos and Andy. Amos and Andy were two imaginary African-American men, but the roles were actually played by two white men, Freeman Godson and Charles Correll. They created the characters in 1928, and they posed as two men living in Harlem, the black ghetto, and spoke in heavy dialect. This was a tradition out of it came out of the minstrel tradition in American popular theater. Now, Amos and Andy is widely regarded as a racist show, although in its day it had a daily audience of nearly 40 million, incredibly popular, and very, very widely loved. And in fact, it had a wide black audience too, many of whom loved it, apparently. It was also the very first show to be put on every night at 7 p.m. during much of the Great Depression. You could listen to Amos and Andy for a few minutes. The Lone Ranger made his debut on Detroit radio stations in 1933. Radio news became an important component as well, particularly in times of crisis. An American journalist, a radio journalist called Edward Murrow, was in England during the German air raids on London in 1940, the Blitz. And Edward Murrow, his description of the bravery and endurance of the British people in the face of heavy German bombing contributed to shaping American public opinion in favor of the idea of intervening in the Second World War on behalf of the Allies. Well, the power of radio is vividly illustrated in 1938. Again, Orson Welles is the crucial figure here. He did a broadcast, a dramatization of H.G. Wells' story, The War of the Worlds. And it's about an alien invasion of the Earth. It was so realistic that many citizens thought this thing was really happening and that they weren't hearing a story. They were hearing reports of an actual invasion, even though periodically Wells interrupted the broadcast to say, here is a dramatic reading of War of the Worlds. One of the characters says, I can see the thing's body. It's as large as a bear, and it glistens like wet leather. That face, the black eyes, and the saliva dripping from its rimless lips. Oh, very, very stagey. Well, apparently, people, and this is supposed to be happening in New Jersey, a lot of Jerseyites fled from their homes, highways were jammed with traffic, bus stations were full of people trying to get away, people fled to their churches expecting that the end of the world had come. President Roosevelt heard about this and thought it was a wonderful joke and invited Orson Welles to come to the White House for dinner. So, but it was a little glimpse of the power that radio could have. Television intensified the effects which had been established by radio. Television was already, the technical work on it was done mainly in the late 20s and 1930s, and commercial TV was viable by the end of the 30s, but was delayed, the mass production of TVs was postponed by the Second World War. After the war, TV grew meteorically in the 1940s and 50s. In 1946, 7,000 American families owned TVs. By 1960, just 14 years later, 50 million. So a massive increase. By 1960, TV ownership was just about universal in the United States. In those days, it was still black and white, of course. It revived the careers of some fading Hollywood stars, such as Ronald Reagan, who made the transition from radio to Hollywood, and then made the transition into TV. And it ran spectacles. Obviously, the visual medium opened up all sorts of possibilities which hadn't been available in radio. One of the first great TV scandals, revealed in 1959, surrounded a popular quiz show called 21. By answering questions correctly, you stayed on the show and won progressively more money. But it wasn't long before the producers recognized that sometimes the people who were best at answering questions weren't the most attractive individuals in all way. So they started fixing the show so that the most likable candidates were also the ones who kept winning. In other words, they'd give them the questions beforehand and the answers. And Charles Van Doren was the young man. He was the son of a Columbia University professor who was shown to have cheated, and to have connived with the producers to get help with the quiz. That led to legislation against abuses of the medium. Television began to play a crucial role in political life. Senator Estes Kefauver became famous for his televised hearings on organized crime in 1951, one of the first times that TV had been used to show congressional investigations in action. And I mentioned another of the most effective moments in early TV history, the Army McCarthy hearings in 1954, when Senator Joseph McCarthy, the communist witch hunter, alleged that the Army was full of communist spies, but conducted the hearings in such a way as to convince nearly everybody watching it that, in fact, the Army wasn't full of spies and that he was talking nonsense. It was the event which really discredited McCarthy. He didn't have an effective TV persona. I mentioned last time how in the election of 1960, between candidate Kennedy and Vice President Nixon, People who heard the debate thought that Nixon had won, but people who watched it thought that Kennedy had. That was an important moment as well, because it demonstrated that from now on, in addition to all the other qualities you needed to make it to the White House, you needed to look good on TV and sound good there. Now, ironically, Nixon had been confident that he was going to ace these debates because earlier, in 1952, he'd had a wonderful success with television. This is the famous Checkers speech, which is another immortal moment in the history of TV. What happened was that he'd been chosen as Eisenhower's running mate, but some of the Democrats, who already had a passionate dislike for Nixon because of his anti-communist activity, which was mainly aimed at the Democratic Party, some of the Democrats had alleged that he'd been getting improper financing, that he'd been accepting, he'd been getting personally wealthy from campaign contributions. Eisenhower said to Nixon, "You've got to go on the air and defend yourself against these accusations, and if you can't, I'm going to drop you from the ticket." Well, Nixon went on the air and gave a speech in which he depicted himself as a humble but good-natured and hard-working, honest man. And he described in great detail what his income was, where it came from, the struggles that he and his wife had had as his political career began. And he talked about the way in which Pat wore a good Republican cloth coat and he was proud of it. But and the climax of the speech came when he said, "Well, now it is true that we did get something from a voter. It was a little dog. A little cocker spaniel was sent to us. And my daughters love that dog, and we're not going to give him back whatever people say. We've called him Checkers." It was a wonderful sort of stirring moment, very, very sentimental. But then Nixon ended by saying, "So it's true that the dog is, maybe you could regard the dog as an improper campaign contribution, but we're going to keep him anyway. Now, I've disclosed all my financial affairs, and I think it's a good thing for candidates to do that. I think all the candidates should do that." And of course, by saying this, he put everybody else in the position of more or less having to make financial disclosure as well. So it's a wonderful way of turning the tables on his rivals. And it had an electrifying result as well. Telegrams poured into the Republican Party headquarters, in effect forcing Eisenhower to keep Nixon on the ticket. It was wonderfully successful. So Nixon had got the idea from that he was great at TV, even though in 60, Kennedy upstaged him. Now, Nixon was back. Nixon was a great political survivor. He was back again as the Republicans' candidate in 1968. And, of course, he was the winner of the 1968 election. A journalist called Joe McGinnis wrote a book about the 1968 campaign called The Selling of the President. And it's all about the way in which Nixon was packaged by his media handlers for that election. This is something we're very familiar with now, but in 68 it still seemed like a rather shocking thing that the candidate should be turned into a commodity. And McGinnis shows how very, very carefully his handlers organized moments when Nixon was going to be shown on TV to make sure that he looked at his best, that he was composed, that they never caught him unawares, that access to him by camera was very closely controlled, and so on. In other words, showing just how important the TV element of these campaigns had become. Well, TV enabled citizens to follow dramatic and controversial events that were physically remote. At the same time, of course, American citizens were watching the Vietnam War unfold before them. The Army had hoped for good public relations by cooperating with the media, particularly the TV people. But in fact, just the opposite happened. TV pictures of dead soldiers, children burned by napalm, the horrific and sometimes indiscriminate destruction wrought by the American forces in Vietnam had exactly the opposite effect. When reporters heard about the My Lai massacre, for example, when a terrified American unit annihilated the population of a village, that began to turn more and more people against the war. This was very different from the way in which the Army had managed the film crews in the Second World War. For example, in World War II, the bodies of dead American soldiers were never shown on film, whereas now it was becoming common. Martin Luther King used the TV to very good effect. As I said, he made sure that his big demonstrations would take place when they were likely to be attacked, because he knew it made dramatic news footage, which so long as his side maintained the principles of nonviolence, would give him the moral high ground. In 1969, the first moon landings were followed on television, and people everywhere watched as the first men walked on the moon. Now, a fascinating transformation had taken place by then. When the War of the Worlds had been broadcast, a lot of people thought it was real, even though it wasn't. With the moon landing, a lot of people thought it wasn't real, even though it was. I've met people who up to this day think that nobody ever really went to the moon. After all, it's clearly impossible, isn't it? And they think the whole thing was staged in a TV studio. Sometimes television people themselves were so ingenious and enterprising that they were able to become the best source of information, better even than government sources. The classic example of that came in 1991 when a CNN news crew was in Baghdad and were able to describe exactly what was happening in Baghdad in the moments leading up to the first American air raids in January. And the American government itself depended on CNN news in part for its information. Religious groups continued to make use of TV just as they had of radio. Fulton Sheen, a Catholic priest, was the first great religious TV star. And in the 50s, he had a show called Life is Worth Living. They were half-hour shows in which he made a point from the Christian tradition. Usually, he was careful not to make it a controversial one about which Catholics and Protestants might disagree. Usually something about the nature of sin or moral dilemmas that we face. He'd practice it earlier in the week at a convent in New York. He'd give the talk to the nuns and they'd make suggestions and then he'd do the show itself. And his show was on another channel from the Milton Berle show. Berle was one of the great popular entertainers of the 50s. And gradually, Fulton Sheen's ratings became even higher than Berle's. When he won an award, he said, "Well, I've got the best possible script writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John." Fulton Sheen, a very, very effective TV personality. He came on with a great dramatic black cape and had a piercing gaze which riveted the attention of viewers. Later, of course, TV evangelists took it up as well. Perhaps the most famous were Jerry Falwell, the founder of the Moral Majority in the 1980s, and Jim and Tammy Baker. Jim Baker himself believed that he'd got a divine vocation to be a TV fundraiser. And he also discovered early in his career that if he wept on the air, people would send in far more contributions than if he appeared to be totally in control of himself. And some of you may remember that his wife, Tammy Faye Baker, also perfected weeping on the air to ensure that contributions were sent in. Well, their great TV evangelical empire crashed to the ground in 1987 because they were shown to have defrauded viewers who were sending in contributions for the ministry, but the money was being diverted to the Baker's private enrichment. Computers revolutionized personal communications and information access again in the last years of the 20th century. Phenomenal developments in transistor technology and miniaturization made this possible. Transistors were invented in 1948 to replace the cumbersome vacuum tubes which had been used in radios and TVs until then. But the earliest computers were huge. They were very hot, and some of them needed entire buildings to be contained and great refrigeration plants to keep them cool enough. But in 1958, a technologist called Jack Kilby invented the silicon-based integrated circuit, and in doing so, eliminated the heat problem. From that time right up to the present, incredible advances in miniaturization made it possible for computers to be made both more powerful and more compact, all the way down now to things like the laptops and palm tops, which have become familiar, palm pilots, which have become part of everyday life. User friendliness as well. It was difficult to operate the first computers, and the computer languages were sometimes extremely alien. But increasingly, companies like IBM and Macintosh worked out how to make the computers user friendly, which is the term we now use. The first video games like Pac-Man appeared in the late 1970s, and the entertainment possibilities of computers also became apparent. The first PC, the first personal computer, was launched in 1981. At first, a very, very expensive device, but like nearly all of the new technologies of the previous century and a half, they began very expensively as luxury items and increasingly came down and down and down in price as more and more of them were made until they become virtual necessities central everywhere. Certainly, the American business world today is entirely dependent upon computers. The spread of the internet in the 1990s and into the new millennium gave ordinary citizens easy access to each other and access to incredible realms of information very, very easily. No longer did they have to go to great research libraries. They could find vast amounts of information just literally at their fingertips. Now, there have been some exaggerated claims made about the global village. It certainly isn't true that that the people of the world are coming to live more and more nearly in harmony with each other. And in fact, some political scientists argue that witnessing the internet sometimes intensifies national antagonisms and certainly the feeling of envy of the poorest people of the world for those of the wealthiest. Political scientists also speculate that information technology contributed to the breakdown of the Soviet Union at the end of the Cold War in 1989. Once miniature cassette recorders and Xerox machines were available, it was very much more difficult for the Soviet Union to get a monopoly on information. More and more citizens were getting access to information which the government didn't want them to have, and that became proportionally more difficult for them to maintain strict control over what people thought about the nature of the world itself. So today we're surrounded by sources of information. It can make us very skeptical. On any subject, you can read opposing points of view, and they all seem very, very persuasive. And I think it's worthwhile bearing in mind that we're by far the most highly educated generation, really, in the entire history of the world, and have by far the most access to competing sources of information and interpretation of that information. Although it's got its negative sides, for the most part, that's clearly a highly desirable thing that we should have achieved this status.